Stay tuned for Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Hi, I'm Attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
If a Middle Earth elf lived today in Southern California, how would she celebrate and support the arts, music, and her community? What would Arwen do? Thursdays with me, Tani Tenuvio, on KUCI 88.9 FM and streaming live at KUCI.org. Ellen Salalumin Amenti Alva. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Heaven sends a song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and happy to be here. And where are we? Going toward the end of July 2008. The show, as usual, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today, my guest is John Ware. He's been on before, and I always love to have John back. He's one of the most eloquent, articulate literary agents in the business and probably in life. He started the John Ware Literary Agency in New York in 1978 after 8 years as an editor at Doubleday, seven of which he taught the industry-wide editorial workshop at NYU. He also spent a year as an agent with James Brown Associate Curtis Brown, LTD. Hi, John. Are you there? I don't think we have him. So what we're going to do is take a little break, and I will find him. He's somewhere. I know that. So don't go anywhere.
Oh,
Okay, we are back. Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara, and I believe we have John on the line. So let's see if he's there, John.
Here, present.
He's there. Yay! I did an introduction of you a little bit ago, and even though you've been on the show a few times, I wonder if you would just take a moment and talk about how you became an agent.
Sure. Most people who come into publishing don't begin as an agent, and I took a familiar, if unexpected, path to it by working in publishing as an editor first, meaning initially as an assistant editor. I spent eight years at Doubleday where I began and worked my way up to full editor, and just had an attractive offer from an agent friend to join his agency, and the size of it, the smaller size of it, appealed to me greatly. The fewer meetings appealed to me greatly, and the independence of it the same. So I was very happy in my years as an editor. The jobs are similar. I mean, in fact, after our respective readings, editor's reading and agent's reading, we negotiate with each other. But there are other aspects to the editor's job that are just, I guess, busier, you'd say, with more responsibilities to many departments, whereas as an agent, you're pretty much involved with writers and editors and the editorial process and acquisition process. You don't get into the other departments as much, which I guess, honestly, I didn't miss. So I've been, you know, even more happy as a literary agent with these positive aspects.
So, and you've chosen to stay more of a boutique agency.
Barbara, I have to tell you that our connection is not the greatest.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's very fuzzy.
It's fuzzy, yeah. You know, I don't know what's wrong, but I know this happens where you can't hear, the guests can't hear, but the recording comes out wonderfully and people can hear it, so.
Okay.
I don't know what to say. I'm going to talk to Mike. That's what I'm going to do.
We'll do our best.
But anyway, what I was saying was, in terms of becoming a boutique agency and staying that way, talk about that, because there are so many huge agencies that seem to, that have a million clients, and sometimes clients feel that they are lost within these huge agencies.
Yeah. I'm not sure I got the first part of what you said, but... Well, I have so stop me if I'm off track. I have and have always had a small, I fancy, elite agency where I really take on books that I love, meaning not books that I like or books that I think I can place, but books that I really would go to the mat for. And I've been fortunate to have notably a couple of very big clients, Stephen Ambrose, most of his life, a historian, and I represent John Krakauer and other writers on their way, I hope, to the bestseller list. But people kid me and say, well, you can be selective with the royalties from those two writers. But the truth is, I was always selective. I think I'm frankly choosy as a private reader. So I've been fortunate to sort of cherry pick my projects over all the years and have it work out.
Do you represent the same material that you read, as you said, privately? Is that what you represent?
No. I was just saying, even as a private reader reading for pleasure, I'm a picky reader.
Right. But what I mean is, are those two things one and the same? You know, the clients you represent and your own personal reading. Is that, or do they differ?
No, they're a match. It's just different material. I mean, I suppose I read what I represent, fiction and nonfiction, more nonfiction. Maybe I'm not understanding your question. There's work reading, which hopefully your clients are writing excellently, and so they're a pleasure to read, and then there's that hard-to-find time for strictly your own private reading of hardcover books.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of stuff thrills you when it comes in? I mean, do you know right away? Do you know when you read a query letter for, say, you know, whether it's a novel or a nonfiction project, that it's something you want to see?
Well, you can, first of all, you can tell more than one might think you could from a simple query letter, and that includes from novelists who, of course, are not doing expository writing in their books. They're doing they're writing fiction. But you can tell quite a bit, obviously, about the content, but also about the writing from a well-done, concise query letter. So I often do get a very strong pull from the letter, or if not, at least enough of a pull where I say, even if I'm on the fence, to say, well, this is worth sampling. This is worth reading some of. Maybe I'll go over the top with a little exposure to it. I'm pretty interested from this letter alone. In which case, then I ask to see. Usually, well, in the case of nonfiction, it might be a finished proposal. In the case of fiction, I would ask to see normally a synopsis of the whole, an informal synopsis of the whole, in about 50 pages, and then go on from there. If I'm pulled in by those pages, then I ask for the balance.
What percentage of your agency is nonfiction, and what percentage is fiction?
Oh, Barbara, it's gone so much in the direction of nonfiction. I would say now it's closer to 90% nonfiction, maybe 80, but somewhere in there. Fiction is very difficult. I seem to attract, probably because of some of those major writers I've represented, I get more referrals on nonfiction. And I don't have as big a track record in fiction as I would like. I mean, that's my only, I think, regret about my career. It just came out that way that I did more nonfiction, and so I'm not on, I don't have a strong track record in literary fiction, so I'm not on the A list to receive those queries. I wish I were. I love good fiction. But I still get some, and so, you know, I make that decision from the gut, whether it's in a letter or when I'm reading sample material. I'm not very scientific. I think maybe I pause after the gut gets grabbed and say, okay, can I envision an audience for this? And that's about as marketing connected as I get it. I find, I don't know about other agents, but I find it really is a it's from the gut response that counts the most.
When you said you now handle more nonfiction, much more nonfiction than fiction, I thought you were going to say because of the marketplace, because of the difficulty in publishing, not because you're not receiving enough of it to choose from. So that's interesting.
It's both, Barbara. It's both. The market for fiction, I mean, I'm trying a little bit of fiction now, a couple that I think I probably might have placed 5 years ago, but I need to leave that out on purpose. That's a piece of reality, absolutely, that I have to be conscious of. It's the fiction marketplace is difficult. You know, on the other hand, with all these little guidelines, as we all know in publishing, if it's, you know, quote, the right book, unquote, fiction or nonfiction, then the world is ready to greet it. But speaking in general, no, I would definitely add what you said. It's, the fiction marketplace is very, very difficult now. Publishers are, I mean, here I think is one of the main points. Publishers used to, if they were interested in the fiction writer, they would give that writer two or three books to perform in a marketing sense. And now, for the most part, they don't get that chance. If you don't do something with your first book, as shown in sales on BookScan and Amazon and so forth, you're probably not going to get interest from that publisher in the second novel, the second try. So that grooming of writers is really gone, as far as I can tell. And I think that's a shame because, you know, some people have to build over several books. They're not full-blown aces on book one.
So what kind of numbers are we talking about then? And could you just say a few words about BookScan for those who aren't familiar with what that is?
Yeah, I really don't know much about it. It's an organization that tracks book sales at all kinds of outlets, although they themselves say, if they don't, I know the industry says, well, if you're looking at BookScan figures, add another 25% because they don't hit all outlets. But they just are a tool to measure at least approximately what a book is doing. I don't know if I can give you a number, Barbara, about performance that would be enough, say, with a novel to interest the publisher in a second book. It's hard to, like so much in our business, it's so unscientific and hard to pin down. I mean, I could say something like, well, even under 10,000 copies, say 7,500 copies, but outstanding reviews, attention of that kind on a first book, that could help. There is no hard sales number. Certainly over 10 would be lovely. But as I say, on a delicate item like a first novel with the proper attention, you can sell fewer and have the publisher say, okay, well, we're sticking with this writer for another book.
Yeah.
Especially if they like the second book.
And BookScan, it's only really accessible by what? Bookstores, publishers, industry people.
I mean, I've never tried to go to it on the web. I'm not sure, although I certainly have never had friends who are lay people bring it up, discuss it. So maybe so.
Yeah. Interesting. We're going to take a short break. I'm going to call John back and see if we can get a better connection so he can hear me. So all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back with more Writers on Writing. John?
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Hi, I'm attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. You can also find us on iTunes if you go to Radio, Public, and then scan down to KUCI. You can listen that way. Podcasts are available 24/7 via iTunes, as well as going to my website, Pen on Fire, clicking on the radio tower, and then following instructions for listening. We have a blog site as well that's dedicated totally to the show. 300 plus shows are up, and you can listen to anyone. You can search out an author or agent's name in the search box. That's accessible at http://writersonwriting.blogspot.com. I've been getting emails from listeners wanting to listen to shows that they can't listen to via iTunes, because once you subscribe, apparently, you don't get the past shows, or at least some people don't. If you go there, you can listen to anything that's been posted, and, you know, many, many shows, and a couple go up every week, so there's lots there. I'm here with John Ware. He's a literary agent in New York City. Let's bring him back on and hope the connection is better. Hi, John.
Hi, Barbara. Not much better.
Oh, well.
But I can, you know, I think I can make it out.
I'll scream. Anyway, I was wondering about, in terms of material, fiction, especially selling, and it being a hard sell. Do you find that genre fiction is easier, or are you not attracted to genre fiction, such as, say, suspense fiction?
Fiction, let's see, which is her. I guess genre fiction probably is a little easier than, general fiction, so-called mainstream fiction, literary fiction. The only categories that interest me, I really put in the various directories, seek non-genre fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What do I say? Literate but accessible. Literate and accessible non-category fiction. The only categories I personally am interested in is a really good mystery or a really good espionage thriller.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I'm, whether it's... what's male macho fiction I'm not too interested.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking of is a book like from a few years back, Snow Falling on Cedars. And the story to that, at least the story I heard, was that it started off pretty much as a literary novel, and then the Gooderson sort of layered on the suspense element, the courtroom drama, and just gave, which gave it more texture, became a different sort of novel, and of course very successful novel.
Right.
So I guess I'm thinking of that sort of book, which could be considered a literary novel but has that suspense element.
The thing is, it's so hard to discuss, isn't it, because we're talking about an individual book in each case.
Yeah.
And often, when one succeeds, now you may have put your finger on a major factor for that book's success and the film as well, but sometimes you just don't know. You really don't know what it is, unless you pick up some healthy word of mouth from around the country, which most of us don't have access to, maybe some views on Amazon. You really don't know why such and such works, and so working with fiction is even more subjective than working with nonfiction. You basically have to say, well, I really like what this writer is doing here. I have a desire, the simplest desire of all, which is the measure, which is to simply turn the pages. You know, I have a desire to do that. And that, I think, is the main guide to, or certainly a main guide to fiction that possibly could sell, that you can't put it down.
Yeah.
And that can be true, let's face it, of very high-toned fiction or some real trash.
Yes.
That is the fundamental quality, though. Do you want to keep turning the pages? Sounds simplistic, but that's, I think, a major goal for writers to write so that readers want to do that.
What about short story collections or collections of essays? Are they impossible sells, or, again, does it just depend on the material, maybe whether the material was published in wonderful journals and magazines?
I think it has to have been, essays and stories have to have been published in journals and magazines of some note. It's just impossible, I find. I think I've only tried once or twice where some stories really knocked me out without credits attached to them. But it's really all but impossible, I would say, with essays and short stories. Sounds odd because with a first novel, you don't need any particular credits at all. But with story collection and essays, you really need to have those before a publisher will seriously consider.
And yet it seems that there are lots of people reading short stories. Some people subscribe to The New Yorker only for the short stories, you know, to see what's going to be out every week. And the same with essays. It just seems that, you know, there are certain columns, Modern Love or various magazine and journals that really specialize in essays that there are readers for, and yet they're difficult to sell as collections. Interesting.
Well, they're probably, you know, if you're reading Harper's or The New York or The Atlantic, whatever, New York Review of Books, if you're reading people in there, those people with those major credits will probably put out a collection of their essays,
mm-hmm,
or stories if it's it's fiction. But that's what I would say. That's the whole point. You've got to have those bona fides on your essays or stories.
Sure. What about crossing over, a nonfiction writer wanting to break into the fiction market? Do you see that happening?
I have two clients who do that. I think it's just two. But sure, there's no reason to not to do that. Sometimes they have different publishers for fiction and nonfiction. It happens rarely, just because it seems most writers are dedicated to one or the other, but I mean, there's no problem with that happening.
But you would still hope to have just one agent that would handle both, so that
absolutely,
you're not split up.
There may be some agents, for example, I don't know any, but let's say an agent who didn't handle fiction, then you'd have to go elsewhere with your fiction. But most of us handle fiction, even if it's a small amount of fiction. So usually you'd work with the same agent in both genres.
And also, you know, we've talked about this a lot, and especially on past shows, but you are an agent that especially likes to get involved with the material, yeah?
Yeah, and I tell you, increasingly, all of us need to get involved with the material, because editor's time, it seems, probably mostly because it's so wrapped up with the marketing department activities. Editors, sad to say, fewer and fewer editors have the time or can make the time to edit. And what that means is that now the more perfect the submission, and I mean as perfect as it can be in every way, the more likely that there'll be an acquisition. I mean, there used to be, well, I would say way more than now, books, more novels than nonfiction, but both, and again, I experienced this as an editor at Doubleday, too, where editors would read it and say, gee, you know, this is really great. Yeah, it needs some work. It needs some work. But, you know, we can do that work. The essence of this novel or nonfiction book is terrific, and let's buy it with the understanding that the author and we will have to do some work, but we can't let it go because the seedling of something great is there. That is much more rare now, because editors don't, as I say, they don't seem to have as much time to edit, and that puts an extra editorial burden on agents. And, I mean, frankly, those of us who were editors before, I think have an advantage because we have a set of skills in that area from working as an editor that a literary agent, say, who comes out of sales or the rights department at a publisher just doesn't have as experience. I mean, it's a definite asset that we who were editors before have because of the increased attention of on the material itself before it ever gets to the publisher.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with New York City literary agent John Ware, who is, as I said, in New York City. And if you want to find him, he's listed in various directories, literary marketplace, writer's market. There are ways to get to agents, and it's best to find out what they represent. How many, rather than how many, do you tend to get queries where the writer has really kind of just blanketed agents with queries and doesn't necessarily know specifically about you and what you represent?
Oh, sure. And sometimes they're what I call mass mailings. Your name isn't even on the query.
That's so hard to believe.
Yeah, they provide a stamp self-addressed envelope, but it's just essentially, "Dear World," and then, you know, then it goes forward. And I don't have a very positive response to these queries. And I usually write back and say, FYI, this, quote, mass mailing, unquote, is a non-starter. Good luck to you. That's pretty impersonal, Barbara.
Well, it's sort of like, you know, getting a dear occupant, you know, occupant with your address on it with something in the mail, and it goes directly into the trash.
That's what it is. It could say dear occupant, yes. Maybe literary occupant, but still.
That's so bizarre.
And other writers really, you know, research me. The directories you mentioned now give us space to list our interests and to list some recent books placed, and so that they are useful. And sometimes I've actually heard more than a few people. Barbara had heard a previous interview we've done on the web and have written me because of our talk.
Oh, that's extremely wonderful.
Yeah.
To hear about.
True, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think when I found you years ago, I remember a listing saying that you liked the blues, or you sang with a choir, you studied Italian. There were various things that really, aspects of you that just made me see a person versus, you know, a literary agent.
Well, we all have other things we would like to do as much as we love books, so... I sang in a blues band in college, and then I sang classical in New York for about 7 or 8 years and studied Italian. It's almost like high school. I feel like I have, other than exercise, and I'm a runner, I have time for one extracurricular activity. So what I've been doing really since 9/11 is mentoring kids.
Huh.
Yeah. Reading and Big Brother and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Which I find very rewarding.
And 9/11 prompted that?
Yeah, I think that I'm a native New Yorker, and I think I've always been very supportive of, I guess you'd say, New York charities, and things like the Police Athletic League or the New York Times neediest cases, more than disease-oriented charities. And I had coached a Little League baseball team with a couple of buddies in the late 80s, and I'd been a camp counselor and so forth, and I gave my funds annually to these worthy causes, in my view. And somehow, when 9/11 came, I just thought, nah, this is fine, but you got to do something hands-on. The money's great, but you got to do something more hands-on in terms of participation. And that really is what... brought me back to, you know, some mentoring.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. Back to this writing thing.
Yep.
What about memoir? Do you handle memoirs and
yeah,
where do you see that going? Is it continuing as usual?
Yeah, I think that's very important to talk about. I do handle memoirs very selectively, but really, and every writer should bear this in mind, the memoir has to have some worldly connection. I can give you a few examples. It can't just be, no one is really interested, unless you're a celebrity, truly a celebrity of some sort, no one is interested in your memoir or mine. Unless there is, as I say, some connection to a theme, subject matter of the world. I've recently placed two memoirs that I think are a good example of this. One of them is a book called Spent, which Little Brown will publish, which is the memoir of a shopaholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see the larger topic there. The other one is a client who, actually, he's one of the few who probably, as a non-celebrity, will get away with two memoirs, not counting what's his name, Augustine Burroughs. By the way, I'll give her the credit. Avis Cardella is the name of the author of Spent, and that will be out next year for Little Brown. This client of mine, Travis Cully, did a wonderful book for Random House. He was a Chicago bike messenger, and he did a book called The Immortal Class, Bike Messengers and the Cult of Human Power, that Random House did nicely with. And then his editor and I discovered, right around the time that was published, that Travis Cully, because that's only when he told us, was virtually illiterate till he was 18 years old. And now he's doing, and it's brilliant, a second memoir on the road to his road to literacy.
Really?
Yeah, what it was like without, and now what is the glory of what it's like for him to have books in his life and reading of all kinds. A very, very moving, very dramatic story. So you can see how those are two examples, or three if you count both of Travis's, that, yes, they are memoirs, but they have a connection to a larger subject of the world. And I've done others of that kind that I could give examples of. But that's the key. It just can't be a setting to paper, as I said, by you or me, of our wonderful life.
Right.
You know?
And
so I hope I've been clear about what it takes.
Yeah. And,
okay.
And also, sometimes it seems that memoirs are successful when they focus on really a particular time in a life. It could be a year. It could be a very short period versus the whole existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's any rule on that. It's just, as I say, got to have that larger pull. And my attitude about considering both kinds is truly black and white. I'm very interested in the memoir with a larger context, and I'm just not interested at all in putting it in my directory's listings of no personal memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
It's just impossible to publish those.
Yeah. What about in nonfiction in general? Do you see trends, or are the same things popular, or does it always come down to the writing?
Well, I think it always comes down in any era to quality writing and interesting subject matter. But I can give one specialized answer to your question, Barbara, and in these times, and that is there's way more contemporary affairs that is selling than usual. I mean, people are really interested, again, I guess since 9/11, in effect, current history. And I think, frankly, history, the general category of history, has been burned a little bit in both book sales and review space because, that's with the exception of Lincoln and the Founding Fathers, which seems to go on forever, because people are so interested in what's happening right now. And that's the biggest trend, something I don't like to even think about, when I'm considering books is, making a guess as to is this genre possible and so popular and so forth. But there's no question that in the case of current affairs, that is a major, major breakthrough.
Mm.
And I'll tell you another interesting one, which is not an area that I work, but the healthiest part of book publishing right now is for children and young adults. It's fascinating, whether that's all to do with Harry Potter or, I don't know, parents reading to their kids sooner or what. It's the financially healthiest part of our business right now is children and young adult books. Isn't that interesting?
That's really interesting. So for fiction and nonfiction?
Both fiction and nonfiction. Books for kids, yep.
Hmm. Now, I have heard that within that the most popular are picture books, and that there are so many people sending out manuscripts to agents and editors regarding picture books.
See, I don't handle them, so I don't feel super qualified. I think they'd have to be something pretty special, mm-hmm. though, because I think the publishing of photography books is pretty expensive.
What about so young adult novels? It's interesting because they seem to be the topics anyway. Seem to be becoming edgier and edgier.
I'm sorry, Barbara, I didn't get that.
That young adult fiction,
yeah.
for instance, it seems that the topics or themes are becoming more and more edgy, where you could be reading an adult novel almost.
I think that's true when you get into the young adults, which I don't know where that stops. I guess it stops around 16, maybe 18. Oh, I think you're right. Maybe the little kids' books haven't changed much, but yeah. The young adults in the teen book for the teenager, I think absolutely it's edgier. Yep.
Hmm.
However, parents may feel about that.
Right. Okay. Well, we have a few minutes left, and what to talk about, where I have so many things I'd still like to talk about as usual. MFA programs. Are you impressed with MFA programs in terms of somebody queries you, they've been through an MFA program? Does that make you take a closer look, or is it still really the writing?
Well, it still comes down to the writing. I mean, I certainly take note of that in somebody's paragraph of autobiographical information. I make note of that because, one obviously does some very hard and creative work in an MFA program. But it's a nice plus. It certainly is not necessary for taking something on, and it's not sufficient. You know, as you say, the writing has to be there, whatever the person's background. But, so I don't know how. It doesn't hurt. It certainly doesn't hurt just to have for agents to pause over to say, well, that's a little plus.
Mm-hmm. Do you troll for clients? Do you read journals or magazines and read something you like and write to the writer to see if they're represented?
You know, I think I used to do that more as an editor. I don't know why. I suppose it's because I'm busy enough with what comes my way. So I think editors do quite a bit of that, and some agents, but I think overall, maybe not as much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't anyway.
Yeah. We are, unfortunately, at the end of our time. I'm sure there's so many things I didn't ask you that I should have. Is there anything, any last words you would offer our listeners?
Well, I just, assuming that your listeners, or at least for the writers among your listeners, I just think you have to keep the faith and work hard. Just believe in what you're doing, believe in the choice you made of a topic to write about, work on your writing, and keep the faith. I mean, publishing is always looking for new writers. So there's no reason to be discouraged about even some of the things I've said in this program, tough time for fiction and so forth. All you've got to do and all you can do is devote yourself to your work, believe in it, and the end of the road, find one of us.
Yeah.
But the first thing to do is just concentrate on your own work with faith.
Yes. Good words. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Barbara.
And great to talk with you again. Sorry about the sound.
Oh, no problem.
That was John Ware speaking to us from New York City. And sometimes we just seem to have a sound problem, and I hope all of you out there can hear. If you can't, email me at penonfire@earthlink.net and let me know, because definitely want you to be able to hear this program. Anyway, that was John Ware from New York City. You can find him in so many different publications. If you Google his name, you will find an article and an interview on my blog with him that further illuminates who he is and what he does. Again, you can reach me through my website at penonfire.com. And let me know if you want to be on the weekly e-list, where I send out emails about who's coming on. The blog is up. You can reach it through the website as well. I'm going to leave you now with a quote by Pearl Buck, who said, "I don't wait for moods. You accomplish nothing if you do that. Your mind must know it has got to get down to work." That's it for listening to Writers on Writing today, July 23rd, 2008. This is KUCI 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I'll see you next week.